We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Ready to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Starting with local and a proposed new transportation taxing district for Seattle.
Yeah, City Council member Tom Rasmussen proposed this week to create a transportation taxing district in Seattle so that they could raise taxes for the maintenance backlog and because the city is coming up short on its funding for their bicycle and their pedestrian master plans, and because there are a whole bunch of other projects in the city that need transportation funding. What I find kind of interesting is that, you know, 4 years ago, voters approved the Bridging the Gap levy, which increased property taxes to collect about $365 million for street maintenance and sidewalks and new signals and bridges and all that kind of stuff, including bicycle lanes and pedestrian improvements. And, you know, 4 years later, you have to ask, okay, we have a bicycle master plan and a pedestrian master plan, and not much money to fund it. So where did the levy money go? Well, sure, we've had an economic downturn in between there, and that affects property tax collections. That's true. However, the city, if you really look at how the city has been spending its transportation funds, a lot of money has been going into these sort of vanity projects like the Mercer Beautification Project and the South Lake Union Trolley. And I kind of look at that and I say, okay, we're not funding bicycle lanes and we're not funding, you know, sidewalk improvements and we're not funding street maintenance, and we let the South Park Bridge close down because we didn't have money to replace that. We put all the money instead into making changes to Mercer Street that don't have anything to do with the traffic flow between Capitol Hill and South Lake Union, you know, through South
Lake
Union.
That's going to make it
worse. Yeah, it's actually going to make the traffic flow worse in some ways. So, you know, and you could argue that, well, that's not really transportation dollars. That's just, you know, I don't know, a gift to Paul Allen or a little bit of boost to the developers in the South Lake Union area. But it's certainly not transportation funding when you're making changes to streets that have nothing to do with improving traffic flow. In that same vein, the city's now announcing that, gosh, we have the money and we're going to start work on this brand new park on Westlake. They're going to close down a one block section of Westlake Avenue between Olive Street and Stewart Street because they want a new plaza there, and the justification for this is to...
So that would close Fifth also, right?
Well,
yeah,
I'm guessing that would also have some impact on Fifth. I don't know if it's going to close down Fifth or not, but it's certainly, if you close down Westlake, you're going to impact the traffic flow on Fifth. Because Westlake and Fifth, that's one of the busiest intersections in the city. What the justification for this project is, they want to have a place where commuters can link up between the South Lake Union Trolley, the monorail, and the light rail line and buses. Well, I look at that and I go, that's crazy.
That would require that the monorail and the South Lake Union Trolley have riders.
Yeah, would actually be considered valid transit projects when they're really not. I mean, look at the monorail, for example. The monorail's on its last legs. It doesn't run during morning commute hours. It has limited runs in the afternoon, and it really doesn't go to a place where commuters need it to go. I mean, we voted down the city, you know, after much lobbying by the city and developers, we voted down a monorail expansion project. The South Lake Union Trolley, again, doesn't function as a real transit solution for people. And the light rail line, the nearest on-street entrance to the light rail line is three blocks away from this new Westlake Plaza. Sure, there's an entrance in the basement of the Westlake Mall, but most people don't even know that that entrance
is
there.
There's no sign for it.
Yeah, there's no sign for it. The mall doesn't promote it, and it's not open most of the hours when people need it to be open because the mall isn't open during a lot of those hours. When the tunnel is open elsewhere. So it really, the Westlake Mall, this new Westlake Mall Plaza, which is going to suck up some $850,000 of transportation funds from the state government is funding this project, is really not a project that has anything to do with transportation. In fact, it's going to create a more gridlock downtown on Seattle city streets. So I look at this
it
and
is,
I go,
it's property development, which is what a lot of these things are about.
It's a
That's what Mercer Beautification is about. That's what the slut was about. It's all about property development. It has nothing to do with transportation.
Yeah. It's exactly that. It's a gift to Paul Allen for the South Lake Union Trolley, and it's a gift to the Westlake Mall owners. It's not, has nothing to do with transportation. That's where our transportation dollars have been going. And I think people ought to go down to the city council and tell them this. Look, if you're going to create a transportation district, let's make sure the money gets spent on real transportation projects, not on these vanity projects.
Didn't I just read recently that the Westlake Mall was, or its owners were putting things up for sale?
Oh, yeah.
Financial straits.
Well, this will solve everything.
And we really need to move on to other stuff, but the whole idea behind developing a transportation taxing district as opposed to just raising taxes already, creating this new structure for bringing money in, it was to get around a public vote?
Well, a public vote on certain things, like a transportation district could impose like a $20 increase in car tab fees and some other little minor fees like that, but a transportation district is not going to be able to raise sales taxes or property taxes. Those things would still have to go to a public vote, so I'm not exactly sure why a transportation district is necessary.
All right, let's move on. The state of Washington is experiencing a budget shortfall.
Yeah, this week Governor Gregoire ordered state agencies to recommend cuts of up to 4 to 7% by October 1st. And then she said for next year, and this is in addition to the $453 million that the state is going to get from the feds from the new bill that just passed and that Obama just signed this week provides like $26 billion from the federal government to states to help pay for Medicare and to help pay for schools. And then she said for the 2011 to 12 budget cycle, all state agencies are going to have to look at something like 10% cuts. Well, you know, we've been doing cuts for the last several years, even during good economic times, so there's really not much left to cut. So what we're really talking about here is completely closing down some programs. For example, Gregoire is recommending that we close and get rid of programs that would provide vision care and dental care to low-income people and to the homeless. She wants to, she's talking about getting rid of state-supported hospice for the terminally ill. I guess we just, you know, turn people out on the street to die in the gutter.
And, what happens is this is short-term savings for long-term societal costs because we wind up paying more in emergency care, both for indigent programs and things like hospice, than is saved short-term. But it's all about the accounting.
Yeah. And then at a time when there's like been an increase of 30% to the welfare caseload in the state, she's talking about some $57 million in cuts to the welfare to work program. And a lot of those cuts are going to be for people who are obviously unemployable, who have been in the welfare to work program more than 5 years and still haven't been able to get a job. So I think, you know, like Job said, it's long-term. We're talking about short-term cuts for long-term societal costs. A lot of those people are going to be pitched out onto the street. You're going to see, and folks on welfare to work are not individuals. They are families. So you're going to see a lot of kids out on the street.
Yeah. The thing with these cuts, though, is that they're not a surprise. The timing around this was the question of whether the federal legislation was going to pass that gave money to the states, and if so, how much it was going to pass with. But it was very clear that even with that assistance, and even more so without it, that the state was going to be very, very short of revenue. And this gets back, again, to a couple of things. It gets back to the actual structure of the state tax load that makes it very, very susceptible to economic downturns, and it gets back to a number of the various Tim Iman initiatives, which have really crippled the state's ability to raise revenue during economic shortfalls. So we see both of those coming up on the initiative ballot again this November with yet another Tim Iman initiative that would hamstring legislature's ability to raise revenue, this time by requiring a two-thirds supermajority for any tax increases. And also we see 1098, which is the high earners income tax, which would at least begin to address the structural inequities of the extremely regressive tax system that's both regressive and susceptible to economic downturns, because over the long term development, the fact that we tax that we're so dependent on sales and property taxes, and that we're so dependent on an ever-shrinking portion of the economy in terms of sales of goods rather than services, makes it much more difficult to sustain during an economic downturn like the one we have now.
All right.
Yep.
Moving on to national and publicly bringing out their plan this week, Google and Verizon figuring out how they're going to divvy up the world.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how it is that telecommunications companies became the people who were being charged with developing the plans for regulating telecommunications companies. But Google and Verizon announced this week that they had negotiated a plan which they are presumably giving to the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, for approval, that would regulate, that would essentially eliminate network neutrality for wireless broadband, that is, internet access on telephones and other mobile devices. It would retain network neutrality for existing landline devices like home networks, but that's going to be an ever-shrinking portion of the market as we move forward, and these companies are well aware of that. So this is something that the FCC is being presented with as a fait accompli. The FCC itself had been trying to negotiate an agreement between a number of the half dozen or so various giant telecommunications companies that are the major stakeholders in this from the business standpoint, but being left entirely unrepresented in this process are the tens of millions of consumers who are going to be directly affected by all of this, and particularly directly affected by a plan which would give preferential treatment to large internet users, which is what net neutrality is all about, is enabling the Googles and Verizons of the world to determine who gets fast internet service and who gets service that is slow or doesn't load at all if they don't like the content of what you're providing. So it's a very alarming situation, and one that calls, I think, once again for people to flood the FCC with comments saying, compromising on net neutrality is not something that's up for negotiation. That needs to be an absolute principle. It's served us well with telephone communications for 80 years, and there's no reason to change it now, and there's certainly no reason to give away the communications technology of the future to these enormous companies to do with as they like.
And it's a false distinction, too. The wireless internet is not completely wireless. Some point, it's got to go through cables and switches and routers. And basically, what they're saying is, well, we know wireless is the wave of the future, and we just want to end net neutrality with the old wired system.
Yeah.
And
add to that also that most home, both phone and computer systems are going to become wireless in the future.
Yeah, so many are now that this proposal is outrageous, and I think people should tell the FCC that.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah. This week, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, last week Fannie Mae, this week Freddie Mac, went back to the government trough for more funds. Both of them had about $3 billion in losses in the last quarter. Last week, Fannie Mae asked for an additional $1.5 billion, and this week, Freddie Mac asked for $1.8 billion in order to, of course, keep propping up the housing market.
You might take a second to explain why it is that they continue to lose money even after all these bailouts.
Yeah, well, part of the reason is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guarantee or own about half the home loans made in the United States. That's about 31 million home loans that are worth more than about $5 trillion. So essentially, they make up the housing market. And when large banks are not loaning, as is true now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac step into the gap. They also provide money to banks to loan for home loans. And that's what I mean when I say guarantee. They provide a guarantee, which means if the bank thinks it's going to lose money on it, Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac step in and they buy it for its face value. And they end up losing the money on it, which means, of course, taxpayers end up losing the money on it. And as I've said before, when Timothy Geithner, the head of the Treasury, and the Fed get together and say, the TARP bailout money, the taxpayers are going to get all that money back plus interest, they're not talking about the money, the billions of dollars being poured into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a total of about $148 billion as of today. Also this week in the economic news, the Fed announced that very quietly, I should say, that they are going to start buying $10 billion of U.S. treasuries per month. Now, this was very interesting. This is what they call monetary policy. The Fed has done the most that they can do to cut interest rates. They've cut the bank lending rate down to almost nothing, actually to 0 to 0.25%, which is literally to nothing. And that still hasn't had much of an impact on the economy. So they're looking at what can we do to stimulate economic growth. And they said this week, well, we'll start buying U.S. treasuries. Well, what they're doing is they're buying 2 to 10 year treasuries, which those are considered intermediate term treasuries. And that those intermediate term treasuries are the interest rate on those intermediate term treasuries is what determines the interest rates on a lot of consumer loans like auto loans, but also the loans that are made to businesses for operating costs and capital purchases. So what they're doing is they're trying to stimulate banks to they're trying to cut the interest rate for banks to loan out to consumers and to businesses so that banks will start doing that again, because banks have been reluctant to make loans to businesses, particularly to small businesses. But I don't think that this move is going to actually have much effect on that. And we'll see. In addition, what the Fed is worried about too is that a lot of people who are buying bonds, we talked about this last week, that a lot of investors are looking for quality investments, so they're buying a lot of U.S. government treasuries, but they're buying short-term treasuries, bonds that are less than a year. Less than 2 years, but in a lot of cases are less than a year, some for only 30 to 60 days or 90 days. And the reason they're doing that is because they don't want to tie up their money in case interest rates increase. Interest rates are going to have to increase eventually. They can't stay at zero forever. And so what the Fed is seeing is they're seeing much higher rates on long-term treasuries because there's not much demand for them. As the demand decreases, the price of treasuries go down and the interest rate goes up. And as the demand for short-term treasuries goes up, the price goes up and the interest rate goes down. People are parking their money in a safe investment that isn't returning much to them, but it is preserving the principal of their investment. They're not losing money on it. They're not getting very much on these short-term treasuries, but they're not losing much. They look at the price and the yield on long-term treasuries, and they go, I don't want to park my money for 10 to 30 years in something that's got a relatively low rate. The interest rate isn't high enough to attract them, but they're not buying those. So the federal government is saying, well, you know, hey, we need to finance our debt. Hello, you know, we need people to buy these long-term treasuries. And the Fed is stepping in and saying, well, if we buy intermediate-term treasuries, maybe that'll create a demand. You know, the price will go up, the interest rate will go down. That'll create a demand for longer-term treasuries. Maybe we can affect the interest rate on longer-term treasuries. You know, so they're grasping at straws. You know, and they're worried too because there isn't demand for the long-term government debt that could put us in a bad position because we have a record deficit and we need to finance our debt somehow by issuing these longer-term treasuries. And what's the problem when you want to borrow money and people don't want to lend it to you? That's called insolvency. So they're worried about that too.
All right. Moving on. Item this week in the Financial Times.
Yeah, Financial Times this week reporting that U.S. prosecutors are investigating over a dozen transnational drug companies based in the United States for bribing foreign doctors. Why is this falling under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? Why is this an issue? Number one, because foreign doctors in many of these countries, particularly in the industrialized West, are public employees, because unlike the United States, most countries have government-run healthcare programs that cover everybody. And so the very standard practice practice that you have in this country of drug companies retaining doctors as, you know, consultants to sell drugs to other doctors and sending them on lavish trips and all these various practices that wind up with a lot of money going from drug companies into doctors' pockets in return for promoting their products. That's illegal in other countries because you're talking about paying off public employees. And then secondly, some 80% of clinical trials for new drugs are now being held overseas. There have been a number of actually fairly prominent cases in the press recently, including a diabetes drug that where the clinical trials that were held overseas turned out to have buried problems with the drugs that have resulted in serious health issues and even deaths with some patients that have used these drugs once they've been brought to market. But when you're having drug trials being held in foreign countries, particularly poor foreign countries, it's much easier to bury non-positive results to these trials and just to come back and report that, nope, there was no problem at all. So it's interesting that, number one, federal prosecutors are investigating this, which is something you never would have seen under the Bush administration. It's one of those subtle differences, for all that we complain about the various things that Obama has and hasn't done, we have, the various regulatory steps like this that are taking place now, which is what the government is supposed to be doing, what it did not do for 8 long years during the Bush era. But at the same time, you had this report coming from the Financial Times of London. You didn't have it coming from U.S. media, because for some reason it's not considered newsworthy in this country that big drug companies are notoriously corrupt.
Yeah, and the New York Times just reported on this story this morning, and they only did it because it was in the Financial Times, and their slant on the story was, gosh, this is a problem because in other countries, they have the other federal governments have such a strong control over their medical, over their entire, and they said over
that
their
communistic
entire,
to me.
Over their entire medical infrastructure. And I just looked at that and I kind of laughed. And I said, as opposed to here where the doctors are bought and sold by the pharmaceutical industries,
And where we don't really care.
Yeah. It was amazing.
All right, moving on to international, starting with Pakistan.
Yeah, interesting response this week. Another major difference between here and the Bush administration, where Bush was very slow to provide assistance to the tsunami victims in 2004 when that hit the Indonesian and the various other Indian Ocean countries, both with the earthquake in Haiti and now with the floods in Pakistan. The Obama administration has been fairly quick and fairly generous with its humanitarian response and with using the military to provide humanitarian response. But the real interesting part of it in this case was that it's a much more effective use of the military from a national security standpoint to be providing humanitarian assistance, even though that's not what the military is trained or set up to do, than it is to be using drones to bomb the SWAT Valley and some of these same areas that are now being affected by the floods, or some of the same areas in northwest Pakistan that are being targeted as part of the Obama administration's stepped up war against the Taliban and the so-called war on terror. In the short term, this is in terms of winning hearts and minds and getting people to isolate the various terrorist and Islamist groups that provide a security threat to the United States to the extent that they do at all. It's a much more effective use of money than the very expensive and hardware-intensive military action that the United States is pursuing. But you have to ask, where is this assistance going to be in 6 months or a year from now? As opposed to Islamist groups who have roots in these communities who are also providing humanitarian assistance in the wake of these floods. And you know that they're going to be there in 6 months and a year, and they're going to be helping with the reconstruction. And it really is incumbent upon the United States to keep doing this and to keep following through and helping out and having boots on the ground, literally in this case. But boots not wielding weapons, but wielding, hammers and tools of construction instead.
Work boots.
Yeah, work boots, because otherwise, you know, you're going to wind up with these other local groups building new schools, and the U.S. turns around and bombs them, and it undoes all of the good that comes from what they're doing now.
Yeah, because the way we did it in the past is we gave money to the government of Pakistan, a lot of money to the government of Pakistan to provide infrastructure and services to the people in these Northwest Territories and in these provinces that are being flooded right now.
None of which they saw.
Yeah, it was pocketed by Pakistani officials or poured into their military, or it may have been funneled to some of these Taliban groups that the Pakistani intelligence services support.
All right, moving on to this week's global warming news.
Oh, yeah. Peat fires.
There's a lot of it.
90-plus degree weather in Moscow. You know, people booking solid the trains that are leaving Moscow because they can't get out of the city fast enough.
And, the floods in Pakistan.
Oh, yeah, the floods in Pakistan, which have inundated a quarter of the country and affected 14 million people. And then 100-plus degree weather in the east coast of the U.S. and in China as well. And hundreds, if not thousands of swimmers in Spain being stung by jellyfish swarms off the coast. I mean, these are all indications of global warming, of global climate change. And yet we still have the media dominated in the United States by, global warming deniers.
I have a proposal. We had also this week an ice block four times the size of Manhattan sliding off of Greenland. That opens up a whole bunch of new land, and I think we need to send the global warming deniers to colonize that new land in Greenland. It can work either way.
It's at sea level, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it's at sea level, so it'll be a nice warmer climate for them than Greenland has historically had over the past few centuries. But at the same time, we'll see whether they really believe their own rhetoric or not, because if they do believe it, then they won't be concerned about their rising ocean levels.
Yes.
And if they don't believe it and decline the land, then we'll know them for the frauds that they are.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, arms sales.
Yeah, a huge new arms sale this week, and happening the same week that you had, yet more of the media dust up over the mosque in Manhattan that's being set up, the Islamic Community Center that's being set up a few blocks from the Ground Zero site. So meanwhile, while you've got the Tea Partiers and right-wing wingnuts who are all in a lather about that, the U.S. announces a hugely record sale of modern weaponry to Saudi Arabia, 84 F-15s worth some $30 billion, another $30 billion worth of attack helicopters, billions of dollars more worth of spare parts and maintenance contracts and whatnot. So let me get this straight. Peaceful Muslims in Manhattan, that's bad. Sending weapons to Wahhabis in the Middle East from the country that, where again did the people who attacked on 9/11 come from? That's good. That's
Saudi
all
Arabia,
to the good, because
Yemen,
that's that's all to the good, because that's military. So we can't criticize that.
Yeah. And, you know, another aspect of this, too, that we never talk about and that you never hear about in the media here is that we make these huge weapon sales to these countries that are supposedly key allies. And then they turn around and they sell those weapons to other folks. And as Jobs said, it's not unusual to find that the names on the list of folks who donate a lot of money to the Taliban and to Al-Qaeda and to other terrorist groups often tend to be even members of the royal family in Saudi Arabia, as well as government officials in these countries that are so supposedly key allies.
All right, events.
Yeah, a couple of them to note. On Tuesday, ballots are due for the rather dreary primary election that has an all-male ballot this time. So postmark them by Tuesday, the 17th. Also on Tuesday, President Obama will be in town doing a fundraiser for Patty Murray at the Westin, and the various usual protests that accompany the President of the United States being in town will be happening. He'll be at the Westin between 10 and 1:30, and protests will be happening at Westlake Park.
Make your sign to air your favorite grievance and go.
Absolutely. So that'll be Tuesday between 10 and 1:30.
Talking as we do every week with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
The endorsement issue is out for that election that's coming out next Tuesday. You can find that where you find free publications at all over town, at bookstores and cafes and King County Library System, etc. Or you can find our endorsement issue online with all our other material at www.eatthestate.org. If you missed that a couple weeks ago when we ran through the whole ballot, it's all there for you, eatthestate.org.